Tonight's topic is Spinoza. We've heard of Spinoza?
He's a philosopher.
Baruch Spinoza.
From Israel. Originally.
Very good. Diamond.
I don't really know much about him.
Okay. Okay, we'll get to all that.
He was excommunicated and he lived in the 1600s. That's all.
Okay, that's pretty good. We've heard of Spinoza?
I've never heard of him. Actually, I probably did, but I probably forgot.
Okay. Benji?
A little bit,
okay. Baruch Spinoza, his accepted name in the world is Benedict. And that is really just translation of Baruch.
You know, the blessing.
Blessing, right. Benediction.
Benediction.
Okay. 1632 to 1677. He did not live that long. He made a lot of impact on the world. And I mean, I hold in a bad way. What am I supposed to tell you?
Philosophies were great. They were so.
Okay, we'll get to it in a moment. That is mamish not true. Okay. Hi. Okay, so it's like this. His father was a Murano, a crypto Jew, who reverted to Judaism a little before his birth, 10 years or so. Of course, as if you've been here, you should know that you should guess without, as Diamond said, that means he was of Portuguese descent, because almost all of people who were like this at this period in history are of Portuguese descent. His father moved to Amsterdam. This is like very classic Portuguese.
Why
Amsterdam? Because it was
the age of the Dutch.
So. That's true too, but that's not why the Jews were moving there. They were moving there because if they would be wait a second. William of Orange is before this. William the Silent is well before that, and William as William and Mary is after this. A little bit after this. It was absolutely illegal and punishable by burning at the stake in many Christian countries if you were legally Christian to kill apostate to Judaism. Of course, we're going to get more back to it next week. There was how much the law was completely enforced. That's a different issue. But in Holland, it was absolutely legal for someone of Jewish descent to revert to Judaism. And we spoke about that earlier, why the Dutch were more tolerant. The Dutch were more tolerant. That is a fact. Well, it's a combination. It started out, this we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, it started out as my enemies are my friends. That's how it started out, because the Dutch were fighting the Spanish, and the Spanish were against the Jews. And so therefore, if the Spanish are against persecuting Jews, and the Dutch will not persecute Jews in order to... They made a lot of profit off of it also.
I thought that was the common ground between all warring nations.
Say again?
Jews. It's our common ground.
Is that what they hate Jews?
It's like the Americans and the Germans in the war that sing Christmas songs, but they fight each other and run in groups that fight Jews.
You're being very oversimplistic, and this is Davka period. This is specifically a period where that's really next week. We're going to get more back to that next week. I really don't want to get bogged down. Next week we'll talk about that more. We're going to talk about the court Jew next week, assuming we finish. I really want to finish Spinoza this week by hook or by crook. Okay.
But after the Inquisition, there is no more Jews.
Okay.
In Spain.
Okay. Sort of like this.
Who's there with him?
What's Spinoza known for? What's his historical accomplishment? His historical accomplishment is what? Ethics? No. No. He did cut lenses towards the second half of his life.
That's what killed him.
That's what people believe killed him. No one really knows 100%. Very good, Diamond. You really know something about this.
I mean, I've looked up stuff on him before.
Like, yeah. Okay. Anyway. Come on, Hammer.
I have that also.
Diamond. Okay. What's Spinoza really known for? He started proper heresy, Kfira, in the modern world. He's one of the forefathers of heresy, of not believing in revelation in the modern world. That's what he's known for, and that's his major accomplishment. What? That chorus, that's why he had a cherem. We'll get to the cherem. I want to go in order. This is a more formal shir than the night center, so let's try to, we have a good question to ask it, but until then, let's try to keep ourselves under control. Okay, there's a major philosophical question. I'm going to have to erase this afterwards. I don't want to be sitting on the board for a week. Pantheism. Spinoza and pantheism the same thing? That is a major question. Now the problem is sort of like this. Spinoza's books are very difficult and very dense and very full of a massive amount of material of theoretical philosophy. You know Yair El-Nadav? You don't? A lot of the S.Y.s know. He's friendly with Rabbi Shmuel. Yeah, here.
Oh, no. I should talk to him, I think, once.
He didn't come in yet this year?
No.
One of the guys, I think Shammah ate by him. Right, okay, fine. So, Yair, who is a bright young man, once attempted to read Spinoza and was extremely unsuccessful. He says to me, it's stupid. I said to him, Yair, anything that people are still talking about 350 years after it was written, certainly not stupid. And
have you read Spinoza?
No, I have not tried to read Spinoza. No, I have not. I've read a lot of things, but Spinoza is not one of those things. I've tried to read some Greek philosophy, not that significantly successfully. A lot of Jewish stuff with whatever I've definitely read. But, when I tried to read Rabbeinu Chasdai Kreskes or Hashem, that might prove to me how far we are from philosophy today. And we might get back to that in a moment. But the question is like this. What is pantheism? No, that's not what's multiple gods is not pantheism. It's rather
pantheism is like
polytheism.
That's polytheism. That's polytheism. Poly's many theism is gods.
Well, pantheon is like a collection of gods, right?
That's true. Okay.
What is the prefix pan? Because in my head is like pan Arabism, pan Judaism.
It's a mix of two words.
All.
Pantheism.
All. You're right. All.
Pantheism.
Pan means all.
All?
Pan-Arabic is
God
all.
Oh, God is everything.
Okay, Diamond got it on the. God is everything. Now, it's sort of like this. Yeah, the literal meaning I wrote down, and this is based on dictionary.com. Everything is God. Yeah, dictionary.com. Everything is God. Now, it's not. The people in the late 1600s, 1700s, who claimed to be following Spinoza, termed themselves pantheists. Modern philosophers, modern students of philosophy have lengthy debates. Was Spinoza really a pantheist or he wasn't a pantheist? And I'm not... wait a second. I want to go through the bare bones of what's going on over here to explain it so we can be like somewhat intelligent about it. Yeah, and he was, believe it or not, you would think he was Ashkenazi, wouldn't you? He wasn't. He was 100% Sephardi. And we're going to get back to that. We'll get to that in a moment, or in a couple of moments. Okay, it's like this. Spinoza was also accused of being atheistic. And not only by Jews, by non-Jews also. Now, Jews accused him rather of kfira, which to call atheism is not really, that's not exactly what he's being accused of. It's sort of like this. There's definitely absolute heresy in what Spinoza said, but it's not, it's like, I'm not sure how much of enough community, whatever. It's a good question if there's any real difference in what brings a person to it or not. But it's like this. An atheist, at least certainly a modern atheist, does not believe God exists. Nekuda. They don't believe that God exists. And as has been pointed out, usually they're not that rational because, again, as they say, to prove something exists may not be simple, but to prove something doesn't exist, an abstract concept doesn't exist, is like almost virtually impossible. So, whatever. So, but that's not what we mean. When we talk about Spinoza being pantheistic, atheistic, that's not what we mean. Because Spinoza, like, it's sort of like he combined a lot of ideas, and with it came up with a non-traditional view of God. He was very deeply motivated by his conception, by his own personal conception of perfection of God. And in Nakilo, if you ask Spinoza, do you believe in God? He said yes. He didn't say no. You ask an atheist, a modern atheist, do you believe in God? The answer is going to be no, I don't believe in God.
What is God, according to Spinoza?
Okay. It's sort of like this. Now, Spinoza combines a lot of ideas which, with the combination of the ideas, then his philosophy, his approach, fits together. A is, he absolutely rejected Chazal. Absolutely rejected Chazal. Absolutely rejected Midrashei Chazal. Absolutely. I'll tell you, it's very fascinating. I was only able to do online research on this. And the people who study Spinoza today are not that interested in that.
Really?
Well, they're not religious Jews, so it's a non-issue for them. I would be interested to know what was his problem with Chazal, and we're going to be more historical about it in a little while. But they don't really discuss it, so I can't give you any reports about why Spinoza rejected Chazal, but he rejected Chazal. Okay, now it's sort of like this though. It's sort of like this. He also, this is a very critical concept in Spinoza. This was not an easy class to prepare, trust me. This is a very, very critical concept in Spinoza. And the concept is are the spiritual and physical two different entities or not?
According to him,
it is. Oh, very good. You really learned something about this.
Yeah, because if you read online, I just can
retain whatever. Right. That's right. Very good. Wait a second. According to Spinoza, the answer to that is no. According to both the Jewish religion and the Christian religion, which I'm not sure how much we really have in common with them, but this we do have in common. I don't ask how exactly they believe in Yashka, because that doesn't, if they believe in anthropomorphism of God, which they do, sort of, then how exactly do they believe in Yashka? Don't ask me, Kasha. As I say, this is a corollary to, that's a corollary to what I say on the famous Jewish phrase, on Chassidish and Masim Efek Nishkin Kasha. We don't, on Chassidic stories, we don't ask questions. And so I say, if on Chassidish and Masim we don't ask questions, then on Christian theology and things like this, I certainly don't ask logical questions like, how do you combine the two? That's not my issue at all. I'm not worried about it. They attempt to do it somehow or another. I don't know. Don't ask me questions on that. Okay. Anyway, Spinoza rejects. It's sort of like this. He believes that God's infinite, but he rejects the separation of body and soul, of spiritual and physical. Now, it's sort of like, I'll step back and say, it's sort of fascinating that the Kabbalists, they, in our world, they argue with Spinoza, but in the final state of man in the world, they hold, this is not as interesting, Shabtai, in the final state of man, conceptually do believe in a combined state of spiritual and physical. But in our world, and the world as we know it, and the created physical world we're in, the physical and spiritual are parallel systems which have a certain... There's a connection between the two. There's a connection between the two. There's a connection. But geometrically measurable. Yeah. You had a question? Okay. Now, Spinoza rejects that idea, and this is going against, it's not only going against Jewish philosophy and, you know, and Torah, etc. It's also going against Greek philosophy and the Rambam. I don't know enough about history of philosophy. As far as I know, this concept of, I think it's called monism or something like that, of saying the spiritual and physical are the same thing. It doesn't mean you don't believe in the spiritual. It means you think they're the same thing. I'm relatively sure that it's a relatively new idea. That it was not a classic idea and not entertained seriously by the classics, which is why, for example, the Rambam doesn't really directly address it, not that I'm aware of. The Rambam at length addresses spiritual, physical, the difference between the two, etc. That is given very solid treatment in the Rambam. But this concept of attempting to combine the two are not given any real treatment that I'm aware of. I mean, it could be it is. I didn't have time to. I guess whatever. I could speak to other people about it, but I didn't have time. Okay, yeah. So, speak. What do you want to say?
I'm not saying that you're wrong, but just is it that he thinks that they're like the same thing more than that? He thinks that one is a perception that the spirituals and the mental is perhaps a perception of what is going on, and whatever you do physically is an extension of your perception. Not necessarily that they're the same, but that they function under one.
I'm not sure. Let's go on. There's some other key parts of Spinoza's ideas that some of them are like comical to say over today, but I'm going to say them over anyway, because they're very, very critical to understand what he wanted. Now, Ki'ilu, because he rejected Chazal, that he believed that Tanakh was anti-anthropomorphism. Got it? Because he rejected Chazal, then see, Tanakh talks about Yad Hashem, Zroa Hashem, Enei Hashem, etc., etc., etc. Now, as I'm like on in the middle of a discussion with Zach about, the Rambam is vehement that you cannot take these things literal. He wants to know, Zach Fremholtz, that means, wants to know, did the Rambam introduce that concept into Yiddishkeit? And the answer is no. In my opinion, the answer is no.
I wouldn't take a lot of it literally.
Okay, whatever. Divergence. But this is like sort of a part of Spinoza's rejecting Chazal, is his insistence on learning Tanakh literally, and hence rejecting Tanakh.
As irrational, on the ground of...
That's right. On the grounds of irrationality, because Tanakh seems to give physical attributes to Hashem. I mean, again, here, I could prove to you...
Why does he reject any limud of Tanakh?
Is that a sitter over there?
Yeah.
Yeah, whip it over. I'll show you it's not only a Rambam. I'll show you.
Here, whip over the sitter. Very literal when he reads it.
Okay, so we'll just wait a second. So as Anam Zmiris, we all should know. I don't know how well we understand it, but Anam Zmiris, we should know. We should be familiar with it. And for the records, the song they sing in every shul, I'm actually curious to know if that's how old that song is. You know the classic one? Yeah, okay. I'll tell you what, I can't remember his name. I don't know if he's there now, but he was at one point in time professor of cantorial department in NYU. Don't remember his name, Sherwin maybe, but I'm not sure if I remember his name. He says that all these nigunim, which quotes everyone does, he holds they're minimally from the Maril, which is 600 years ago. For example, you know, okay, how old was that one? How old is that one? That one was recorded. See, the problem is like this. Jews only started using... Yeah, I'll explain why. Jews only started recording musical notes in the 1700s. That one, a monk who was a part of Charlemagne's entourage, heard that...
That's a really long time ago.
That's 900s.
800.
That's 700.
That's 800.
That's
1200 years. Because he has he left, he had a diary, and he commented that he passed by a synagogue, and he heard this very beautiful song, and he recorded the notes of it. And those notes appear...
Charlemagne.
I'm not a historian of music.
So you assume that's before Charlemagne, a little bit before Charlemagne.
Yeah, so it must
that's right. Okay. Okay. So these. Okay. Anim Zmiris, the Nigun for Anim Zmiris is very old, and Anim Zmiris itself is around 850 years old. And as it says in Anim Zmiris, Dimu Oscha Vlok Fi Yeshcha, V'yashvucha Lefi Ma'asecha. When we speak here, you really have to see a little more than that over here to get it totally in context. But we compare you, we say comparisons about you, not according to what you really are, not what you really are. And we equate you, and the way we understand God is by his actions. And that's the mainline approach. I'm just trying to show you that's not only Rambam, Anim Zmiris is an Ashkenazi Python. I could be before, maybe slightly after. Even if he was slightly after, most Ashkenazim in these things were not that influenced by the Rambam for a significant amount of time. So, Dimu Ozra Vlok V'yashcha V'yashvucha V'yimasecha. That is the kernel of anthropomorphism of God. That when we see these terms in Tanakh that say Hashem had this, Hashem had that, does not mean literally. That is very mainline rabbinic approach. Okay, for whatever reasons he rejected it. Now, comically, sort of, and at least the way I look at it is, and these ideas all fit together. Spinoza was a determinist because he equates God with nature. Ki'ilu, that's what pantheism basically does. Wait a second, listen carefully. Because of that, he holds that God did not create the world. Ki'ilu, God had to create the world. The world is chiyuvi. The world must exist. He's a determinist. The world must exist. If he would have admitted that God created the world, then that would have disproved his entire concept of God. His conception of God as being the universe, ki'ilu, and the universe as an expression of God, it goes hand in hand with his opinion of determination. Everything must happen. The world must have come into existence.
Why must it?
Because if not, if once you say, because again, if I separate, when you have God on top of the world and running the world, then God has will. But if you say the world is God, then God does not have will. So how does the world exist? So this is, it's sort of like Lee Spetner, Dr. Lee Spetner says about most Darwinists. And he's really a very firm Jew, you understand the problem does exist, which is, you may be good biologists and historical biologists, but you don't know anything about mathematics. And the key problem with evolution as an actual theory and how life came into existence is the numbers don't make any sense at all.
Wow.
Oh. And the numbers, you don't get the numbers. The numbers are astronomical. What's the possibility of you learning, of you winning 5 lotteries in a what row? None. Because each time for you to win the lottery is like one in 20 million.
Is sheer on disproving.
Okay, I'm diverging. Wait a second. We're sticking to Spinoza tonight, and we have about 12, 15 minutes. I want to get all of Spinoza done. I do not want to leave Spinoza for next week. See, in modern terms, it's not, you know, as I heard once from a deep yeshivish thinker, and he's right. You can't really disprove evolution. You can ask a lot of questions on it, which what I call an open-minded scientist will say, you know what, you're right. I don't have a good answer. But at the end of the day, is the only way they can explain it is with evolution. But the point of all that is even the devoted evolutionists like Hawking will absolutely admit that you can't say the world had to come into existence. Rather, it's here, and this is the only way I can explain it.
Well,
Right.
You understand? Yeah. But Spinoza is well before all of this. So he had freedom of speech and could run his mouth however much he wanted. So he thought the world must come into existence, and that eliminates the need to have an intentional creator. Because Spinoza was not an atheist in the modern sense that he didn't believe in God. He did believe in God.
But as a system.
Okay, very good. Very good. This is like a hard question. Like, to historically ask, what would he say today? Who knows? I don't know. Is it not that's an interesting theory. I don't know. Good question. Okay, fine. Now, Spinoza's ideas slowly make it into public. He was not alone. And the question we could ask here, and it's a legitimate question, is how much is Spinoza a product of his times? How much isn't he? That's a very legitimate question. In other words, Spinoza was a person who grew up in a family of Portuguese, originally neo-Christians, crypto-Jews, etc. And as a result of that, so even though he himself grew up totally Jewish, but his father didn't. His father was actually born in Portugal and grew up legally Catholic. Of course he knew he was Jewish, but there was an inborn skepticism inbred into a lot of Portuguese Jews because of this. And there's a well-documented Portuguese crisis of belief in this period from when they're coming back from the late 1500s until 1700, that whole period of time. It's a well-documented Portuguese Jewish, crisis of belief. So he's not the only one. I mean, of course, the Ramban says, and if anyone could find this without asking Rabbi David, I don't know if anyone else would get it. Rabbi David will like, hey, yeah, sure. It's not fair. The Ramban says, you can ask anyone else you want. The Ramban says the most...
Rabbi Willard.
You can ask anyone else. Anyone else can identify this Ramban on the spot, I'd be impressed. I mean, I'm not impressed that Rabbi David can. It's just I'm sure he can. The Ramban says explicitly that the most fundamental rule of God's interaction with this world is Bechira. Ramban. It's not in the Igeris. It's somewhere else. It's the most fundamental rule of divine interaction with man. That is not. I don't think it's. If you can find the Igeres Ramban, I'd be curious to be interested to see it. But that's not what I want. I know where it is before somewhere in Chumash. Anyway, but Kitzer, the point is Torah is anti-deterministic to the extreme, as both the Rambam and Ramban say. And the Ramban doesn't quote the Rambam, even though he echoes his language. And that is that without Bechira, Schar and Onish make no sense at all, and the Torah is predicated and assumes Schar va'Onish. So to say it's like, yes, to a certain extent, Spinoza was a product of his background, to a certain extent. But of course, you have to understand that all the Portuguese Jews didn't end up like Spinoza, the majority didn't, and there was a nice amount of them who ended up as significant Talmidei Chachamim, most famously Menashe ben Israel. We've heard of Menashe ben Israel? Menashe ben Israel, we've ever heard of him?
I think so.
Menashe ben Israel was one of the Rabbanim in Amsterdam, who actually Spinoza learnt by for a period of time. And he's most historically famous for going to Cromwell and trying to convince Cromwell to allow the Jews to come back into England.
Yes, I heard of Israel.
Right. You've heard, that's what he's most famous for. Cromwell agreed, but he couldn't quite push it through. He couldn't quite push it through Parliament. Complicated. We'll get more to that next week. Wait a second. It was Jews were unofficially allowed into England from Cromwell, and they weren't officially allowed. They were not officially allowed into England until early 1700s, and were not allowed. They were not allowed to become official English subjects until I believe 1740. Okay. Anyway, so what happened to Spinoza? So Spinoza's ideas get out, and people hear about him, and eventually he gets put into Cherem. Now, what we do know, I say the nuts and bolts of being a historian is caring about dates, names and dates. If you don't care about names and dates, then you can't, history doesn't like work. So it's sort of like this. Here's what I uncovered, and with uncovering this, we'll proceed on. Exactly when, we know when Spinoza was put into Cherem. Spinoza was put into Cherem March 1656. No, 10 years before. 10 years before. It's 66. This is 56. He was put in the Cherem in March 1656. March 1656. Now, his father died when he was 21, which is in 1643. And we do know that Spinoza said Kaddish for his father for the traditional 11 months in Shul. Now, there, besides being put in the Cherem, there is a very famous episode when Spinoza was walking in or out of shul, and he had an argument with someone about, is Hashem physical or not? And he, of course, said yes, and the other person attacked him as a heretic and attempted to kill him. When exactly did that famous, legendary episode happen? So, what I want to say is like this. So, I would guess, my guess is like this. He davened in the shul, in the synagogue, which was attached, part of the Talmud Torah where he had studied earlier. He had studied at the Talmud Torah, at a cheder Talmud Torah, and he davened at the synagogue attached to the yeshiva. Okay? He paid his dues in full. Up through December 1655. December 1655 is when he stopped paying, when he lowered his pledges, and afterwards he stopped at all, and then he was put in the Cherem. But not over the money. That was not the issue at all. The issue rather was his opinion. So I would rather than put the knife slashing episode at the year he was saying Kaddish. I mean, Fakir, the only reason, it's like, I would say he was still in a state of philosophical limbo when he bothered saying Kaddish for his father. Because, as everyone you can ask, I don't know whose parents have lost a parent, but if your father's had to say Kaddish for one of his parents, or you know anyone who's done that, it's a real shibud. Even if you daven, even if you're a good Jew and you go to shul 3 times a day, if you have to say Kaddish, that means you have to get there at the beginning and stay till the end. That's not an easy undertaking, as you know, the rabbis will tell you, etc. Now, we shouldn't think, we should not project modern, you know, and it's to a certain extent Spinoza is the first prototype of the secular Jew, and that's what he ended up becoming. After he was put in the Cherem, the Chiddush of Spinoza was that he didn't convert. Most Jews who were put in the Cherem and thrown out for Kfirah went and converted to Christianity, to some form of Christianity. Spinoza didn't. He retained his identity as a secular Jew. I'm not sure if he's the first person, but he's certainly the first known person we know who did that. But we shouldn't project retroactively to non-committed American Jews, or not that committed, who when their father dies all of a sudden show up in shul and start saying Kaddish. I don't think that's an accurate projection. I think rather it's the other way around. He started out as part of the community, and whether he might manage to come to davening 3 times a day, 365 days a year, I don't know, probably not, but that was part of being Jewish, was the social part was showing up in shul, and community was much smaller and tighter than it used to be than it is today. And it's definitely true, we can show from Tshuva Sakronim, etc., that it's always been a problem to get everyone to show up. But still, most people come a significant amount of the time. you know what I'm saying? So, I think that this incident with the knife attacking incident, I would date to after he finished saying Kaddish, not before. Okay. Chup. Anything else in Spinoza? Maybe one other thing? Okay. How much did Spinoza affect the Jewish world? In his day, not that much. But in larger terms, because Spinoza laid philosophical ground for, rational deism and pantheism, which was, I mean, it was the, you know, the intellectual dynamite of the 1700s, and that came back and flipped into the Jewish world later. In the, you know, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, Enlightenment, etc., then yes, in the biggest picture, he had tremendous effect on the Jewish world, and I think we could definitely say that the effect was quite negative, quite negative. Is there anything else I want to say? I think that's all I have to say on Spinoza. Fine. Kind guys.